And that's a scenario something like this. And we call that scenario entanglement harvesting. And we discussed a little bit the formalism. And in the end, for a particular simple case, we found that entanglement harvesting, or a measure of entanglement for the two atoms, is a function of, so it can be written as two competing terms. One is that a local kind of term, and the other one is a non-local term. The non-local term, if the non-local term has a higher contribution to the, well, if it's bigger than the local term, then the state will be entangled. If the local term dominates, then the state will not be entangled. So again, that means that harvesting entanglement from the field with a coupling principle is not trivial. I mean, of course, you can. It's also non-trivial to design a coupling that transfers the entanglement properly, even if you had complete engineering about the Hamiltonian. But with the Hamiltonian for first principles, it would be a function of how strongly you switch, how fast you switch. Now, of course, if you are doing things related to quantum information or ever done, someone would say, oh, but that's easy, though. Fine. I might not be from first principles, but if I had godlike control on the Hamiltonian, can I actually harvest all the entanglement I want? And how much entanglement is there? You see, there are several questions. How much entanglement is there in the field? What do you think? Is there a lot, a little? So the field is infinite dimensional. And the entanglement in the field is max rank. You know what the words, if I say max rank, do you know what I mean by, okay. What I mean is that in the Smith decomposition, you have all the terms. So the entanglement is distributed in all the dimensions of the space, if you want. So in principle, there's a lot of entanglement in the field. Things like if you trace out the field except for a chunk, you get an entanglement entropy if the field is in a ground state that is infinite. It's divergent. So someone may say, okay, with qubits, it's kind of easy, right? With qubits, if I have two maximally entangled qubits and I want to get A and B entangled through interacting with them, I do a swap gates in both of them. Swap gates would just transfer the entanglement one to one, completely disentangled the two qubits and entangle A and B. Doing something similar with fields is non-trivial. In fact, there's a whole line of research on that, how you actually put information into the field and extract entanglement from the field, if possible at all, and what kind of things would you use? There's no such thing as a swap gate for quantum field states and detectors, okay? You cannot do anything like that. But if you just go by first principles, as in the way hydrogen atoms get entangled with the field, through the field, right? Through interacting, harvesting entanglement from the field, you just find, no, it's possible, actually, you get it, but it's a function of, there's a competition between the local term and the non-local term. So if you switch suddenly, for example, the coupling is too noisy, and the local term dominates, and then there's no harvesting, or it's very limited. However, you can prove that if you switch smooth enough, this is therefore a Gaussian, this is one of the results for a Gaussian switching. You get two atoms, well, for a smooth switching, sorry. Now, if you use Gaussians, then you may want to talk about what you mean by space-like separation. This boundary here represents kind of the end of the light cone. But if you have a Gaussian switching, those things are not compactly supported. So what do you mean by spatial separation? You can still have a notion of spatial separation. If the two detectors, for example, are more than 10 sigma away from each other, then the contribution to this kind of thing that comes from causal contact is of the order of 10 to the minus 100, and therefore you can completely neglect that contribution. In fact, what you can do with Gaussian switches is we'll separate them enough so that the contribution coming from the overlap is less than the machine precision of the machine. So in effect, that is a compactly supported switching. The machine doesn't see the tails. So if you're computing numerically. Think of a smooth switching. You can prove that for a smooth switching, you can get, no matter how far away the detectors are, there's always a regime in which you can get the two detectors entangled. This is a binary plot, which means gray means no entanglement at all, red means entanglement between the two detectors after the interaction. And you see, if you're very far away, This is everything is adimensionalized in terms of the duration of the interaction. If you are very far away, all that you need to do is to increase the gap of the detector, and you will get into the region of harvesting again. Okay, you pay a price. The amount of entanglement you can harvest decreases really fast as you increase the gap. Decreases polynomially with the distance and exponentially with the gap. So you're not going to be able to do it very, very far away because the amount of entanglement you can extract goes down really fast. But in theory, you can always find regions in which entanglement harvesting is possible. And this is distillable entanglement. So you can get a little bit and then distill all the way to Bell states. Yes?
What's the intuition for why increasing the detector gap increases the entanglement?
I can give you intuition now how much accurate that is. So the intuition, when you increase the detector gap, you're protecting the detector against local noise. So increasing the detector gaps makes it less likely that you see a vacuum fluctuation local in the detector, completely correlated, because it's very difficult to go from ground to excited if you increase the gap. So it's protected against noise. On the other hand, the non-local term is also affected. It's affected with you increasing the gap is kind of like making it difficult for the correlation terms to actually grow. But it's affecting more the local terms. So increasing the gap basically shields the process from the local noise term. And of course, decreases the non-local one. That's why you get smaller amounts of entanglement as you go up that curve.
And basically, the local noise terms would just destroy the coherence?
The local, not as much destroy the coherence, but the local terms, of course, cannot contribute to entanglement. And they're, I mean, as we saw just generalized yesterday, Friday, the non-local terms is precisely what the local terms is precisely what the correlation terms compete with in the measures of entanglement we computed. More questions? All right, and this is just I'm gonna brush through it because we have 1 week and we have three topics to talk about and hopefully a discussion. Okay, so if you want to see the math, it's in this paper. It's a long list. Those are long calculations in general. But you already know how to do them. I mean, you were here on Friday when we said. So a quick summary of some results. It's not that all that there is, but it's some results in which, so I'm going to talk a little bit about these two briefly. But you can do the same thing without the scalar approximation and talk about hydrogen-like atoms and do entanglement harvesting from the electromagnetic field. In those cases, of course, there's exchange of angular momentum between the detectors through the field, or extraction of angular momentum if you want. And then it becomes not isotropic because coupling with the electromagnetic field is not isotropic. The orbitals are not isotropic. So it depends on the orientation of the atoms and so on. But basically, it's the same kind of phenomenon. You cannot choose the coupling strength, it's basically given. Okay, here's a result, an interesting result. Entanglement harvesting depends on the geometry of the background spacetime. So entanglement harvest, how many of you know about something called the Gibbons-Hawking effect? No one. Okay, so the Gibbons-Hawking effect goes a little bit as follows. Imagine that you have a detector stationary in flat spacetime with proper time, so it's stationary, and let's say, but it's in flat spacetime, so you can assign coordinates tx corresponding to the inertial frame of the center of mass of the detector, and then you ask, okay, when the ground state, when the field is prepared in a KMS state with respect to the time of the detector of temperature t, what is the response of the detector? You compute that. The detector responds Planckianly, as we saw. We already did that calculation as a Planckian response. Agreed? All right. Then you can ask the following question. Imagine that I am in the sitter space, so an exponentially expanding spacetime. And now in the sitter space, I place a detector. I say that I have a conformal theory. Conformal theory meaning like it doesn't break conformal symmetry. That's what I mean. So you get a massless, conformally coupled scalar field to the geometry. And you prepare that in the ground state. And by ground state, I mean in curved spacetimes, there is a problem with defining ground states of quantum fields, no? I really don't know how much you've seen of this thing, so you tell me. Does anyone know why it's difficult to talk about a vacuum state in curved spacetimes? Who knows it? I mean, I know you know it. That's, have you ever heard about anything like that in your lectures? Okay, so in curved space, so how do you define the ground state of a quantum field theory?
Energy is zero.
The energy is zero. Okay, how do you define the energy? No, no, that's a good answer.
Is it because in curved space time you have non-zero stress energy tensor?
No, but that's not what I mean. Oh, that we can get into. Oh, that's amazing. We can get into those discussions as to what kind of energy gravitates, what kind of energy doesn't gravitate, which is kind of cool because the word energy is kind of like more blurry. It's in like, yeah. Okay. How do you define? I guess you could say something like, it minimizes what. If you talk about stress energy density, if you want, it minimizes what, the expectation value. But what if you have huge fluctuations? You know, I can have a state with zero expectation value of the stress energy density still have huge fluctuations. Is that a ground state? The main problem with the ground state of a theory is that, remember how we define it. We have usually have a Hamiltonian. At that level, we talk about the ground state. And we say, yeah, there is the eigenstate of that with eigenvalue smallest, zero, for example. And then if you are for quantizing, you say, oh, yeah, it's the state that is annihilated by all the annihilators, right? And then you call that the vacuum, all the annihilators of the modes of the field, the solutions. Now, in curved spacetimes, the problem is that to define a Hamiltonian is akin to defining a time. Like, OK, Hamiltonian as seen by whom? And as we saw from the Andrew effect, different people disagree on the Hamiltonian of the field. And different people disagree on what a particle is. And if they disagree on what a particle is, they disagree on what the vacuum is. Remember, for the assignment that you did, the homework that you did, for the Minkowskian vacuum, for an accelerator observer, that's not a vacuum. Agreed? So the vacuum of a quantum field theory depends on the observer. Every observer can define, even in flat space-time, that's also true. I mean, I was talking Andrew, right? So that's flat space-time. But someone can say, no, hold on. But the problem is that you are accelerating. Like there is a time-like symmetry in time-like isometry in flat space-time. You have a time-like Killing vector. And therefore, those are the people who can define the vacuum, the ones that actually have the same symmetries, if you want, as the theory. Mm? So that kind of singles out a particular family of observers, right? But in curved space-times, two geodesic observers, which is kind of saying the equivalent to two inertial observers, two geodesic observers will not agree in general on what a particle is, will not agree on what the annihilation operator is, and therefore will not agree on what the vacuum is. Defining the vacuum in curved spacetimes means that there's no such thing as the vacuum. There is one vacuum per person that you add, if you want. At every point in spacetime, even geodesic observers would not agree on what the vacuum is. So talking about the ground state of the theory in curved spacetimes is tricky. Doing quantum field theory in curved spacetimes, do you guys get to see quantum field theory in curved space? That makes me sad because you get to see a lot of things that are like come after that, you know? Like you kind of jump, I guess. You say basic field theory, then relativity, right? And then they jump to things like ADS-CFT, string theory, and things like that. Well, string theory, after all, is flat background, so. But quantum gravity and things like that, there's something in between. And that something in between is kind of the most accurate thing that we know of that works, which is quantum field theory in curved spaces. So we treat everything that's not gravity with quantum field theory and everything that's gravity with GR, and we put them together. And you do elements of that in every other advanced, when you are in advanced courses and you are talking about, we have a scalar in anti de Sitter, and so what you're doing is fields in curved spaces, only that you don't formally study it, right, apparently. There are many books. The one that is the equivalent to Peskin and Schroeder, if you want, for QFT, for quantum field in curved spaces, is Birrell and Davies. I would recommend it. Now, if you want to read more about quantum fields in curved spaces, there's one that is totally recommended. I like it a lot. Fabri Navarro Salas. That one's called Modeling Black Hole Evaporation. I say it kind of center on black hole evaporation, if you want, but it introduces pretty well quantum fields in curved spaces. All right, and of course, Birol and Davis. Birol and Davis is kind of called Quantum Fields in Curved Space, and that book is like kind of like basic reference material that is not every. This book is old-ish in the sense that things have happened since then, but it's good. And it's kind of, again, it's a reference kind of book that is good. All right, so talking about that now. So defining the ground state, defining the vacuum state of a quantum field theory in curved spaces is tricky, but you have a lot of symmetry, but then it's less tricky, if you want. In cosmology in general, and you have heard this in all the courses that you take, in cosmology in general, people would say, in cosmology, we talk often about something called the adiabatic vacuum. Have you heard those words before? No? OK. The adiabatic vacuum, if you want, is the state of the field that comparing the asymptotic past with the asymptotic future, so in mind that you have two regions, the past and the future, the generation of particles is minimized. So of course, if you are in mind that in the past, you are in something that you call the ground state for an observer in the past. So you have a geodesic observer in the past, and that person says, oh, this is the state that, according to me, has no energy. And then you say, come in, come in. All right. So according to that observer in the past, they say, oh, it's got no energy. And then you get an observer in the asymptotic future. And in the asymptotic future, you again, that observer says, OK, I have this Hamiltonian for the field. And they ask, OK, how many particles is in the state that was the vacuum state for you? What is it for me? And for you, it's a state that, of course, is not a vacuum, but it contains the smallest amount of particles possible. That, more or less, is a hand-wavy way of defining what people call the adiabatic vacuum. Again, I recommend that you read quantum field theory in curved spaces, above all if you're doing or interested in things that jump already to kind of like ADS, CFT, and things like that. Much better to know what's in between as well. Okay? So the asymptotic vacuum is something that, it's a way, you see, that's the problem. Oftentimes, and this is sometimes it's good to understand why it could be frustrating. Oftentimes we do things in quantum fields in curved spaces, and we say, we start from the vacuum, or we define the vacuum. Or, oh, why? Why did you privilege a state among all the possible states that you can call the vacuum, which is like an infinite amount of them, because and they're not equivalent to each other at all. Why do you choose that one? Why do you assume that in the early universe, you assume that you're almost in the adiabatic vacuum, for example? Why? You see, in flat space-time, it's unambiguous to talk about a vacuum state. But in curved space-time in general, it's not. So why do you choose a privilege, a particular state? Do you have good reason? What is the physics behind the choice of that vacuum being a good one? Jose, do you know any reasons to choose the adiabatic vacuum, for example?
But not any adiabatic vacuum. You have to select first a family of solutions, actually.
The one that you can normalize in the end.
The ones that can implement the quantum dynamics. This is unitary at each time.
Right. The thing is that...
Guillermo and Bellini.
Yeah. That's tricky, though, because the notion of unitarity you're talking about is not the notion of unitarity of generating translations with respect to a particular T.
Actually, in this scenario, I think it is. They're not talking about the next matrix between an initial and a final time, but that the Hilbert space is conserved through the evolution.
The volume of phase space is conserved through evolution, right? Because here's the thing. When you do unitary evolution according to any partial T, all those things are always unitary as long as the state is defined. So if you don't have a divergent, very divergent number of particles, if you want, you can talk about unitary evolution, no problem. And the only thing that it fails is because you may have divergences. But if you formally write it, it's still unitary, no matter what. But yeah, no, I mean, the thing is that like the choosing the state of a quantum field, when someone tells you in any course, advanced course, oh, we start from the conformal vacuum or the adiabatic vacuum or things like that, or we pick that state, you may want to perhaps ask why that state and not any other. They're definitely not equivalent at all. All right, so in the case of full conformal symmetry, which means let me take the Sitter space, for example, and let me take a massless field. And the coupling of the field, scalar field to the curvature is a conformal coupling, as in like we have conformal symmetry, meaning like the theory is invariant under conformal transformations. So if your action is invariant under conformal transformations, then picking the vacuum becomes very easy as well, because you pick what is called the conformal vacuum. The conformal vacuum, if the action is invariant under conformal transformations, what you get is that the vacuum in the asymptotic past is the vacuum in the asymptotic future. In fact, the vacuum doesn't evolve. So there's one state, or one family of states, if you want, that is invariant, and they're propagating it to the future. And that's what we call the conformal vacuum. That conformal vacuum is, you need a lot of symmetry to have it. And the only reason to pick it is because of that symmetry. Again, not that the physics tell you, and so on. It's kind of a nice vacuum, as in like, yeah, ground, stays ground if I don't touch it, kind of. OK, fair. That's a good reason, maybe, to pick it. Anyway, so the Gibbons-Hawking effect tells you that you cannot distinguish locally. If you have a detector, and that detector is in the conformal vacuum in the Sitter geometry, and is coupled to a scalar field, that detector will have a Planckian response. And the temperature of that Planckian response would be the Hubble, the inverse of the Hubble length. So a detector in conformally in expanding universes, if you want, sees a thermal bath as well, at least if it's the Sitter. Okay. Now, can the detector distinguish the Sitter conformal vacuum from flat thermal state with the same temperature? And the answer is no. The response is the same. The detector does not see the difference between flat space and thermal state or conformal vacuum in the Sitter. Now, entanglement harvesting does feel the difference. Like if you do something instead of local, you do it quasi-local, and by quasi-local, by local if you want, you have two detectors now, and these two detectors coupled to the field. These two detectors individually are going to see a thermal bath, and the temperature would be the inverse of the Hubble length. But the entanglement they acquire sees the large scale structure of the geometry. It can see that the geometry is an expanding geometry. This is the difference between the thermal case, but not the Sitter, and the Sitter case, the blue. Yeah, and this is the region in which you can distinguish the two. It gets better even. Entanglement harvesting can see different topologies too. Entanglement harvesting can distinguish, so just so you see, this is the difference in harvested correlations between several cases. So here we compare Minkowski, well, this one first, Minkowski with periodic identification. So you identify the topology of that space as kind of a cylinder kind of topology. It's all flat. This is cases in flat spacetime, all of them. All of them are flat spacetime. The difference is that in one case, you have a cylinder kind of topology, and you compare it with Minkowski without the topological identification. And here is a Möbius strip kind of identification. So you can get Minkowski, then flip it, and identify the points like that. And yeah?
Is that 1 plus 1D in both cases?
Not necessarily, but in one dimension. If you do it in 3 plus 1D, you do it in one dimension. OK? The difference between, for this particular case, the difference between the usual topology, or the, if you want, flat, let me call it, I don't know what to call it, like the usual open topology and other topologies for flat spacetime make a difference in the entanglement that the two detectors can acquire. And the thing is that you start noticing these differences when the detectors are separated by lengths, if you want, that are much smaller than the topology kind of length scale. It's not that we waited enough time for the signals to come back or anything like that in the closed topologies that we have. No. It's actually really not the vacuum. This whole point is about, you see, there are other results that are along those lines. This whole point is about the vacuum knows, you can see without light, right? You can see what the room is like without really light. But the way we're used to seeing is by sending light, right? And then light comes back. Or something is sending light and light gets to our eyes. And that's the way we are used to seeing things. But of course, if you have a room, right? And you let the room thermalize with the environment, the quantum fields living in that room are going to know about the room. You kind of set boundary conditions and or dynamics, depending on how you say it. And the state of the field thermalized with it. So the vacuum state of quantum fields knows a lot about global structure. It's got time to thermalize with it. So of course, I mean, a simple one, you would know if you live in a cavity or in free space, but you don't need to wait for the light crossing time of the cavity. You know that the levels are, the energy levels of the field are discrete, for example, right? And that doesn't require you to wait all the way for the light to go to the wall and back. Another result in how to see without light. If you are, imagine that you live inside a hollow shell. You have, you know, a mass of the Earth kind of shell, but hollow, and you're inside. What would gravity be like for you? People know that. You don't feel any gravity. Space-time looks pretty flat. In fact, it's flat inside. Now, imagine that you're at the center of that shell. How can you tell if you are in a shell or in free space? Well, one way is, okay, I can send an electromagnetic pulse, right? And this electromagnetic pulse will get, say that the shell is transparent. It's completely invisible. Like, you don't see it. No fields interact with that shell. Gravity does, though. It's got a mass. But it doesn't interact with the fields. Well, you say, okay, fine, I can send a pulse still, and the pulse will notice the discontinuity in the, or the discontinuity, not discontinuity, the jump, the inhomogeneity of the metric that's behind in this propagation, and it will carry information. There will be a transmission reflection coefficient in the boundary because of the background gravity, you know. After all, in the wave equation, we have the metric in there, right? And then, of course, we pick coordinates, there's gonna be something felt as you go through, and then that signal can come back. Yeah, sure, you can do that, but you don't need to. You can actually, if you wait, so if you have an equilibrium situation, like your theory, your quantum field is thermalized, if you want, with the environment, say in the vacuum state. The vacuum state is gonna feel, it's gonna know that you have, well, here is flat, but you have sparse field outside. The quantum field is going to have to thermalize in a way that knows that outside is sparse field and inside is flat. So with a single detector and the response of a single detector, in the way we computed it here, the response of a single detector can tell you you live in a hollow shell or if you live in flat spacetime. And that is without having to wait for the light crossing time of the shell. You can do it in times much smaller than the light crossing time of the shell. So you see, because your definition of seeing, coupling my eyes to the electromagnetic field. So you see that you live in a hollow shell before you need to see the shell. See what I mean? You see it through the field that has thermalized with it. Okay? Well, this is similar to that, only that entanglement harvesting is more sensitive to these things because it's no longer a local measurement. So things that a local measurement cannot distinguish, entanglement harvesting can distinguish. All right, questions or anything? I know this is a bit of discussion rather than doing this time, but I think it's a way to go. All right. Right, so many questions, right, may come here as in like, it depends. If you're a more applied kind of mind, you would say, okay, hold on. You can harvest entanglement from a quantum field. Like, can you do it? How, what are the limits? Like, can you keep doing it? You talked about an infinite amount of entanglement and so on. Can you just keep doing it and extracting entanglement? Or how does that work? Might not have an optical cavity or something. Can I just keep extracting entanglement and so on? Let me tell you a little bit about that. So if you have a finite size cavity and you keep extracting entanglement, you're going to put noise into the cavity. You're going to increase the entropy of the cavity. You keep entangling detectors with the cavity, with the field in the cavity, and you're going to increase the entropy in it. So it looks like in a finite volume, perhaps you kind of face a limit in how much entanglement you can extract. But I'm going to tell you about something like, well, in fact, you can sustainably get two atoms entangled through interaction with a quantum field in a cavity. But it's not enough to just harvest entanglement. You need to have two kinds of mechanism. You need to be in regimes in which you are harvesting entanglement and a kind of relatively fast coupling, but also the atoms need to be able to communicate. And I'm gonna talk a little bit about that little result. Yeah, here's a problem. Okay, so we need to go. So we're talking asymptotics here. So we're doing the process many times and we want a fixed point to show up. So we need to compute for long times asymptotically after many times of doing the process. Also, we are in regimes that have to be really fast interactions. And also, we need to be able to model the communication between the two atoms and so on. So what we've done so far is saying, right, sure, yeah, relativistic, right? So you don't use these two. You don't use these two, the rotating wave approximation or the single mode approximation. But what we've been doing so far is perturbation theory all the time, right? We've been doing Dyson expansions. Now, if you're interested about asymptotics, so all that we've been doing is this. We've been doing perturbation theory. We assume, yeah, whatever the interaction with the field is not strong enough to do much to the field, right? But if you want to know what happens with the field, there's a residue in the field, and how that will back react in the new couple of atoms that we couple, you can no longer do this with perturbation theory. You're going to do substantial changes to the field. Okay, so you need other means. There are several ways in which we can go about the physics of particle detectors non-perturbatively. I'm not going to talk about many of them. I'm going to talk about one particular one, which is what I call here Gaussian methods. But there are other ways. You can do non-perturbative calculations with detector models and quantum fields. Can become complicated, but it's kind of neat. And if I had enough time, I would show you how to do delta couplings as well, like very fast coupling. Very fast coupling can be non-perturbative. And it's kind of nice because you remember the Hamiltonian? The Unruh-de-Witt Hamiltonian was, if you want, a field operator times a detector operator, right? So the exponential of that is a control displacement operator. The exponential of the field operator is a displacement operator, so you create coherent states. But now it's the parameter of the displacement is a quantum degree of freedom. So you get something called a control displacement. So you get things like similar to cut states, to superpositions of coherent states. And it's kind of nice. But that's not what I'm going to talk about. I'm going to talk about what you can use in here, which is the Gaussian methods bit, which is kind of nice to mention. This is something that in quantum optics is often done. Usually kind of focusing on kind of single few modes kind of thing, but you don't need to. It's really powerful, and it's actually mechanics. Here's the thing, right? Observation. Quantum mechanics is computationally difficult. Think of filling a cavity. That's pretty simple, though, because it's like infinite but discretely infinite harmonic, countably infinite harmonic oscillators in a free field in a cavity.
If you want.
But it's still difficult because if you have n harmonic, even a system of n harmonic oscillators, right, the dimension of the Hilbert space is infinite, even for one of them. Agreed? And that makes it tough to compute. But maybe you're not interested in the whole Hilbert space. Maybe you just want a little bit of the Hilbert space that's interesting to you. So let's talk about Gaussian states. So Gaussian states, let me define them as states whose Wigner function is Gaussian. Have you guys seen Wigner function in your course? Aggie would know that. They've seen. Okay, nice. So I don't need to explain that. The Wigner function is Gaussian. Wigner function is the quasi-probability distribution in phase space, constructed in a particular way. Everyone, even if you don't know what I mean by Wigner function, you know that classically you can talk about points in phase space, and you can describe evolution as if you want a trajectory in phase space. But then again, in quantum theory, you cannot have points anymore because X and P at the same time, that's kind of problematic. So you have distributions. Yeah. And those distributions, while in a Hilbert space, you can talk about probability distributions and so on, in phase space, you cannot talk anymore about probability distributions, which is nice because this is something that people use. You know, what is quantum and what is classical depends very much on the context. For example, if I ask you if a state is quantum, okay, if I pick a particular state of the field and I tell you, is it quantum or is it classical? What would you look into to tell me? Whatever quantum system you can think of, even the simplest. Why don't we talk about it? What ideas? I give you a state and I ask you to tell me, is that a classical state or a quantum state? What would you reply to that? What would you do? How would you test that? How would you figure out? You have any ideas? Yeah.
You'd have to go case by case and look for distinctly quantum effects, because the notion of classical and quantum might be very different. Like normally, like a negative Wigner function is one measure of quantum versus classical, but Gaussian states, I don't think, satisfy that.
So, okay, good one. So you're talking with advanced knowledge here. Here's the thing. What is quantum and what is classical? Sometimes people, what is characteristic of quantum? And people would say things like, oh, superposition, right? No, would you agree? That's characteristic of quantum. But here's the thing, superposition. How does that manifest when you build a density matrix? That's non-diagonal terms in the density matrix, no? Right. But the density matrix is a self-adjoint operator. You can always diagonalize that. So there's always a basis in which it is diagonal, and there's no coherences that you want. OK, so you can always understand a density operator as a classical mixture rather than a coherent superposition in some basis of some observable, right? So true, like if you pick a particular observable, then maybe you can talk about the quantumness of your thing in terms of superposition, but not in general. That doesn't give you a general notion of what is quantum or what is classical. And what Andrew was saying is that, well, maybe we should define quantum and classical in a context-dependent kind of way, as in, like, let me give you a definition that I think everyone would agree with. Quantum, as a state is quantum, when you are describing an experiment in which the result cannot be explained by any classical theory. Do people agree with that? That's definitely quantum to me. That you can, of course, you require. You can explain it with a quantum theory, and you cannot with a classical theory, any classical theory. Right. So then we get to this thing. Gaussian state. Gaussian states have a Gaussian Wigner function. That's nice, because if it's a Gaussian Wigner function, then you can understand it as a probability distribution. People would say that, all right, yes, in general, for quantum states, for a quantum theory, the distribution in phase space cannot be positive definite in general, no matter how you build the distribution. You can do it many ways. You have ambiguities. You can do it classically. This is something we do. We can build probability distribution in phase space by demanding their probability distributions, as in, like, instead of having points and trajectories there, I have probabilities, because I don't know. Think of classical ignorance. I don't know where I am in phase space. So I have probability distributions of being here and here, and those evolve and so on. That you can define pretty well in a classical theory. In a quantum theory, it's kind of ambiguous because you have exponentials that don't commute with each other, and there's an infinite number of ways of defining the something that classically will give you a probability distribution. And the thing is that you cannot have them be positive definite anymore. In particular, the Wigner function will not be positive definite for many states. And then people would say, oh, that's, here's a measure of quantumness, right? Because if you do a classical, a stochastic classical theory, meaning a theory where you don't really know where you are in X and P, you have uncertainties, same as in quantum, only that they come from your ignorance. You have a classical theory behind, but this uncertainty comes from your ignorance. Then this thing should be a probability distribution. And then, of course, if you have states for which the Wigner function is negative at some point, you call those quantum, because there's no classical theory that can reproduce them. Agreed, people? How do you feel about that? It's pretty neat and pretty well defined in terms of what it said, but here's the thing. States with, another thing that I wanted maybe someone to tell me is like, what about quantum entanglement? Is entanglement a truly quantum thing, only quantumly? Is it quantum or is it classical? It's definitely quantum, no? Right, you can build Gaussian states that are entangled. So they have a classical Wigner function, as in like always positive and a probability distribution. That means there's a stochastic classical theory that can describe that, yet they have entanglement. Like, yep.
Isn't that just correlations then?
No. Entanglement of the kind that can violate Bayesian inequalities if you allow me to do any measurements on them. But it definitely, are they correlations? No, they are correlations. Entanglement is a kind of correlation. But don't have a classical analog in the sense you can violate Bayesian inequalities with them. You need to do measurements on them that are not Gaussian. So the quantumness would come from the way in which you do the measurements. But they do have entanglement. They're non-separable states. So you see, like for example, squeeze states, like multimode squeeze states, the thermal field pair. That thing is a classical state in the sense that it has a Gaussian Wigner function. So that means that there's a stochastic classical theory that that can reproduce the theory. Here's an aside, by the way. I know two of you probably know this, but probably, I mean, I hope. But here's the thing. How do people build your quantum theories in general? As in, like, I don't know, where do Hamiltonians come from when you do, say, classic quantum mechanics? Say again? Right, where does the Lagrangian come from?
Your pocket.
Huh?
Your pocket.
Kind of. So here's the thing. Oftentimes we say, right, in classical mechanics, we have, say, that kind of Hamiltonian, right? And you say, oh, well, the quantum version of this is easy, no? That's definitely a free particle quantum, no? Just put hats on things, no? Right, people? How about if I give you a Hamiltonian, classical Hamiltonian like this? What would be the quantum theory? It's very ambiguous. So the quantum theory is, you would say, okay, fine. You can just put hats in it, right? Because this is not self-adjoint if you do that. But then you have to do it like somehow, maybe like this. Maybe, no, perhaps, maybe like that. No, these two things go to the same classical theory, right? Oh, thank you, yeah, appreciate it. But then again, we'll have to switch it off at some point. Right, they are the same classical theory. This is a completely different monster for this one. Picking your quantum theory to be this one, or picking your quantum theory to be this one, it's changing your quantization scheme. And that has wild consequences in the dynamics of the system. Okay? So all those things are something that is classically well-defined. Quantumly might not be as well-defined, as you know. Can we switch off? Do you know how?
Yep.
Without switching off anything else? That's kind of cool. All right, fantastic. So, right, so we say states that have a positive Wigner function are classical, we can say. But then you have to give that squeeze states are classical then. So in particular, multimode squeeze states are classical. So states with quantum entanglement are classical. How is that? So the notion also, for a free theory, there are particular examples of those, like the vacuum state. Is the vacuum state of a quantum field theory a classical state or a quantum state? See what I mean? Like, but clearly, if I have the ground state of a classical field theory, nothing happens. I couple detectors, atoms don't even de-excite themselves if there's no field. Agreed? There's no such thing as spontaneous emission in the vacuum state of the field, if the field is classical. You need a field. Quantumly, it happens. In a quantum field theory, there will be vacuum fluctuations and the whole thing will go off, right? Oh, but it's a Gaussian state, so it must be classical. See what I mean? And of course, you have, so here's the thing. The thing is that, in a way, they're classical. So another way of talking about classical and quantum is like, OK, in my experiment, I have a handful of observables. And those observables, if the expectation value is kind of comparable to the uncertainty, then I'm going in a regime that I cannot be classical. And then someone said, but hold on, maybe you can be stochastically classical. This is what's behind this kind of thing. The idea is that instead of imagine that the states are Gaussian. So if the states are Gaussian, I don't need to track the whole distribution anymore. I need to track just the average and the first moment and the second moments, right? And that's enough to track the whole thing. So then you don't need the whole Hilbert space description, and you don't need the whole probability distribution description. Maybe the dynamics of the expectation values and the second moments is enough. Now, the interesting thing is that if you go back in time and you talk with Lagrange and you tell Lagrange, here's a theory. It's kind of cool. It it's not your mechanics, it's not what you are doing, it's something else. I call it Gaussian quantum mechanics. And that theory is described by, instead of knowing X and P, you cannot know X and P. The uncertainty principle, right? The uncertainty principle is classical or quantum. The uncertainty principle is basically saying, you don't have points in phase space, you have distributions. Agreed, people? You have ignorance in phase space. And Lagrangian, so you have something like the uncertainty principle. We say delta x, delta p is larger or equal than h bar, equal than the h bar divided by 2, because you're Gaussian states. Those are the ones that saturate this uncertainty relationship. And then you go to Lagrange and tell Lagrange, this is a completely new theory. And you have this, and look, you have something I call this entanglement, of two more squeezed states entangle and so on. And this is nothing like what you are used to doing. Lagrange would look at it for a while. I mean, I'm assuming that Lagrange is really fast as well, because probably. Lagrange is like, hold on. You're really not, what you're doing is not different from what I do. You're doing mechanics. Only what I do most of the times is mechanics of scalars in phase space. But you're doing mechanics of two forms in phase space. You're doing mechanics of things that are more than just points. You're doing mechanics of funny objects. I don't know why you pick those objects, but this is just a classical mechanics of those funny objects. In fact, Lagrange probably would not say classical mechanics. He would just say mechanics. So this thing is definitely classical. So Gaussian states are definitely classical, but we have to be careful when we use the word classical around. All right? In fact, that entanglement that you have, if you only have what we call Gaussian operations, Gaussian measurements, you will never be able to see it. But if you allow to have measurements, for example, that are not Gaussians, don't preserve Gaussianity, then you will see that entanglement. And in fact, you do see it. In experiments, we use that entanglement all the time. So yeah, I don't know, a little debate on what is classical and what is quantum. It's kind of a fun topic. All right, so Gaussian mechanics basically tells you, Gaussian quantum mechanics tells you, OK, fine. Just store the expectation values. And for simplicity, let's think zero mean, right? All the expectation values are zero. And then store the second moment. That these are the correlators of all the quadratures that you can have, x's and p's. So if you have m plus n harmonic oscillators, and I separate m and n because in the end I want to do detectors versus field modes, right? So m detectors and n field modes in a cavity, then you can have you can describe them by this vector of quadratures with all the positions and all the momenta. If you go to the literature on Gaussian quantum mechanics, the definition of these two may vary. As in, like, sometimes the people write 1 over 2 instead of square root 2. Don't ask me why. I don't get it. But people write sometimes 1 over 2. And sometimes they don't write anything at all. I get the 1 over root 2, and I get the nothing at all. The 1 over 2, never. Maybe, Aggie, you know? Sometimes people do 1 over 2. And it drives me mad, because everything changes, all the normalizations and all the things. I don't know. I don't want to. Maybe they have a reason. All right, so of course, Gaussian states, and talking about Gaussian states would be kind of pointless if you start with a Gaussian state, by time evolution kind of takes you to a non-Gaussian state, right? Then why would you, I was only keeping track of the first moments and second moments of my distribution because it's Gaussian, but now it's not Gaussian. So what am I doing? Well, if your dynamics preserves Gaussianity, so in particular, if the Hamiltonian that couples think of the m plus n harmonic oscillators with each other, is quadratic, then it preserves Gaussianity. The unitaries generated by this Hamiltonian will map Gaussian states into Gaussian states. Quadratic, like this. This is a quadratic form. You can also have, of course, a linear term in the quadratic form, as long as it's a quadratic form. Okay. All right. So preserves Gaussianity. In particular, the one I wrote here even doesn't displace the state. It just makes it rotate and squeeze it in different dimensions. All right. Oh, you remember the Andrew DeWitt Hamiltonian? It's definitely quadratic. Anyway. All right, so the thing is that, yeah, sure. So I can simplify the whole thing the same way that we simplify mechanics. I don't know if in your mechanics, when you saw mechanics, some of you may have seen it, depending on where you studied, I guess. Did you see like symplectic formulation of mechanics? No? Okay. The symplectic formulation of mechanics is powerful. It's the way to do mechanics like properly. It's like the geometry of phase space. Let's actually do mechanics through the geometry of phase space. And this is the quantum version. But it's kind of interesting because oftentimes we explain the quantum versions of things and not the classical ones. But okay. You know the difference between a symplectic space and a metric space in geometry? How many people know that? Okay, so just very quickly, because otherwise I'm just throwing words. How do you define a metric space? I mean, you have a manifold. Let's say you have a differentiable manifold. Then you say, okay, let me pick a symmetric two tensor. I call it G, right? And that's symmetric twice covariant, if you want. And that G, I call the metric. And the manifold together with that metric allows me to define distances and talk about things like that, right? And you have a metric space now. What if instead of taking a symmetric two tensor, you take an anti-symmetric two tensor? What does it become? Well, then you have a symplectic structure. So the symplectic form, this thing here, in fact, yeah, whatever. The symplectic form, this thing here, so the symplectic form omega is just this. This is the identity, OK? The symplectic form kind of plays the role of what the metric plays in a metric space. And the symplectic form is kind of nice because if you see the symplectic form, I'm telling you the hint here, it's like the imaginary unit, no? The symplectic form plays the role. So when you write in Hilbert space kind of evolution, something like that, if I write, I can generalize it if you want like this, where this thing, now it's a matrix, if you want, such that the square is the minus identity, right? So that thing generalizes the imaginary unit, if you want. Okay? Anyway, so just a tiny bit on this. So in Hilbert space, right, you know that the evolution of the observable x, which is all the quadratures, the vector containing all the quadratures, is some unitary map like this. But we said that is kind of difficult because we have too many dimensions in the Hilbert space. And we're not interested about all that. But you also know, oh, yeah, if the Hamiltonian is quadratic, then the Hamiltonian would be, well, this plus a translation, because the Hamiltonian I wrote was quadratic without the linear terms. So worst case scenario, you get that in Hilbert space, it would be a rotation of the vector and a translation, an affine transformation. Basically, I'm telling you, if you have the Wigner function, if your dynamics preserves Gaussianity, all that it can do is, OK, move to a different state and maybe squeeze it, or maybe rotate it too. See what I mean? That's what this is saying. It's a linear transformation on the vector. The linear transformation is the squeezing and the rotations, reflections, and things like that. And you can have also a linear term, an affine term in there, that would be displacements. And then you say, OK, cool. Symplectic transformation in phase space. So how do a symplectic transformation like this one affect the collection? Remember sigma? Sigma was the collection of correlations. I call it a covariance matrix because I store all the covariances of the Gaussian distributions. How does that affect the covariance matrix? Well, that's easy. You know how things evolve in time in Hilbert space, but then just deduce. I mean, start plugging things in and collect them, and then take expectations and take the covariances and see how the covariances. So how does the S, if you want, depend in time? If you plug in here what these states are in time, you substitute basically this thing here. You find a relationship, an equation, if you want, for the matrix S that does the symplectic transformation that squeezes or rotates the state. And the equation is like this. This F, remember what the F was? It's the coefficients of the quadratic form that is the Hamiltonian. Okay? So you got an equation that tells you. So this is kind of a Schrödinger equation, if you want. This is the generalized I of the Schrödinger equation. So what this is telling me is that, what plays the role, the Hamiltonian. So what this is telling me is that, OK, fine, given a dynamics, then I know that the symplectic transformation that implements the transformation in phase space satisfies this kind of Schrödinger equation. And look at this. We went from an equation on infinite dimensions, even for one harmonic oscillator, right? So we have n plus n infinite dimension collections of Hilbert spaces, tensored. Now we have here something, these are matrices now. And this is n times n by m times n matrices. So you have a finite dimensional problem here. You have a differential equation and matrix that are finite dimensional. How nice it is. So you've simplified the problem quite a lot. All right. So if you want to do this, use this, this is just Gaussian quantum mechanics. And by the way, if you're interested in quantum optics, people in quantum optics do this all the time. And very cool stuff in that. Usually restricted to a few modes, but they do it all the time. And if you want to read more about that, you should read quantum optics books. They talk a lot about the phase space distributions, the different kinds you can have, what do they mean, et cetera, et cetera. Even Aggie has like a blog post, you know, that maybe you can share with them.
I have a video, but it's not, it doesn't exist anymore.
Okay.
I don't know if that's what you mean.
I mean.
Oh, no, 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 you don't mean my, yeah, you no. mean Jess's, yeah, I can send it to them.
That's a good one, I think. Anyway, if you want to know more about that. Anyway, Gaussian quantum mechanics is just the quantum version, if you want, of phase space mechanics. The geometric, the symplectic formulation of classical mechanics. If you're interested in that, many books around. Those things, that was super trendy like at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century. Like when topology and geometry were so trendy, formulations of mechanics and symplectic formulations of mechanics were also trendy. Anyway. So the nice thing about that is that now we can do non-perturbative dynamics because we don't have the problem of the complexity that we had before in generically time-dependent problems. And you can do, except for the fact that you need to limit yourself to a finite number of harmonic oscillators, though. So you have in a cavity, you don't need to do a single or a few mode approximation, but eventually you need to cut off because in a cavity you have an infinite number of modes. Well, OK, so if you have problems that are convergent in the number of modes, then you can do it with this. All right? All right, so, and let me just tell you the last thing today. Let me tell you about a protocol called entanglement farming. So imagine that you have a cavity in the ground state. So, and then you have two atoms going through a cavity preparing the vacuum. If you send them through, for sure, we already discussed that the atoms can get slightly entangled through two mechanisms, right? If they're long enough, they can exchange quanta if you want. Or they can harvest correlations from the state of the field, right? All right. What if it's at a finite temperature? So you have a cavity that is not at absolute zero, but some finite temperature. So if you have that, then what you get is that in general, there's a temperature in which the atoms don't get entangled anymore, very fast, actually. So that's bad, no? OK, but what can you do, though? Let me do this. So imagine that I start with the field in an arbitrary Gaussian state, for example, a thermal state of the field. But it could be an arbitrary Gaussian state. The nice thing about, you know what is super nice? The composite quantum systems, the density matrix of a composite quantum system that is uncorrelated is the tensor of the two density matrices, right? You have two systems uncorrelated, the density matrix is the tensor of the two. Agreed? The nice thing is that in the symplectic formalism, the covariance matrix of the composite system, if they're uncorrelated, is the not the tensor, no. It's an affine structure, it's the direct sum. The direct sum is much easier for us humans than the tensor product. Do you people agree? Incredibly easier. As in, like, the matrix is just sigma A, sigma B, sigma C. Ta-da! But computer, a tensor product is way more complicated. If you want to represent it matrically, you can maybe get, I don't know, a Kronecker representation. It gets bulky and complicated. You cannot separate the sectors at all. Agreed, people? Here's where correlations live. These are the correlations. Here. So the covariance matrix formalism is particularly nice to do composite systems as well and compute. All right, so let me shoot the atoms through the cavity. And of course, the covariance matrix now evolves. You have correlations. By doing that, you've created correlations between the two atoms, between atom one and the field. between atom two and the field and so on. All right. Then the next thing that you do is you throw away the atoms. And then you throw now a fresh pair. By throwing out the atoms, we go into a different sector of this thing. The partial states, of course, are the ones from here, but you, the correlations, you just threw them away. You're not going to use them for anything. OK. Then send a new pair of atoms and repeat the process and keep doing it, like several times. And the question you can ask is there a fixed point to that dynamics? Right? If you keep doing it, will it go to a fixed point? In fact, there are theorems that guarantee that there has to be a fixed point. So how do you compute? OK, this is basically how you compute the fixed point. But it's not difficult. So the whole point is that you can have, under some conditions, you're going to have a fixed point, theorems that guarantee you there's a fixed point. And also, you can actually find it. Basically, you can prove that the fixed point is, if you interact long enough, there's a fixed point. So if you allow the system to actually communicate, the two atoms to communicate while they're inside, there's a fixed point. The nice thing is that you go towards the fixed point fast, as in like, look, we start from different states. The vacuum state, well, for the vacuum state, you extract the most entanglement at the beginning, and then you kind of make it dirty. The vacuum state, you put in entropy in it. And then, of course, the amount of entanglement you can extract per cycle. This is amount of entanglement per cycle of repeating this thing. Goes down as you make the state more dirty. But if you start from a thermal state, you see you cannot extract any entanglement at the beginning. But as you keep going, suddenly you activate the thermal state. The thermal state is no longer thermal. You just throw in atoms to it and not letting it thermalize. And you're kind of moving this to the fixed point. And in fact, this is how fast you go to the fixed point. For three cases. Temperature, so 0.5 and 1, and in natural units refer to the scale of the gap of the atom. This is freaking hot. The gap of the atom, if it's, say, it's visible light that the atom emits. So T equals 1 is kind of the temperature of the layers of the sun that emit the light that we see. So this is like thousands of Kelvin. And this is like half that. So we're talking super high temperatures. So you start with a very high temperature thermal state, still you drive it to the fixed point relatively fast. So in principle, that's the end of it, sorry. Yeah, good, because time. In principle, you can keep repeating this process of throwing atoms through the cavity, no matter what the initial state is. And alone, the process would, at the beginning, would yield nothing. But eventually, the process will have you throwing atoms through a black box, which is an optical cavity, and then the atoms come out entangled. And I call it farming because you're kind of putting entanglement into the field. You're driving the field state into a state that has entanglement, and then you allow that to be now a black box that allows you to entangle. And you can do the thermodynamics of these processes and talk about energy balances, talk about cycles, talk about repeatability. And it's kind of an interesting topic. But here's the point. If you care about applications of entanglement harvesting, you can have it through entanglement farming. You can actually build a device that is an infinite source of entanglement. Of course, you need a lot of care, and you need to do it. This is a theoretical result, assuming that the cavity is a perfect closed system and all the stuff, so there's no leaks. And you know that cavities have leaks. So it's a non-trivial thing to implement if you want, but it's something that you can do. The thing is that there are probably other better sources of entanglement, more efficient than this, as in like parametric down conversion, perhaps, or even others. But this one works, as in like you can drive. The nice thing about this one is that you don't have to care what the initial state of the field is. It's driven by dynamics. The dynamics take you to the fixed point that allows you to extract entanglement. Anyway, that's about it for entanglement harvesting. I finished exactly when I wanted, which is nice. Two more topics to go. Tomorrow, we're going to talk about communication when relativistic considerations are taken into account. And then we're going to talk about quantum energy teleportation. And after that, it's just, if there's any time left, I'd be hoping that we have a discussion or something. Maybe you should tell people to come for the last, you can do that maybe, for the last lecture. You should tell them to come. So we have a discussion, something like fun about it. Because again, keep in mind what I'm covering are like bits and pieces. RQI is diverse. There are many results and many people. Anyway, questions that you may have about today. Cool. So I'll see you tomorrow.